I was left almost without an identity because I had wrapped so much of my identity up in the business. So I kind of had to, I had to reinvent myself in a sense. Went through some pretty difficult times.
Hello and welcome to the Growth Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing SMB spend without buying ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Joe Stafford from Trinity Biz Advisors. And Joe has a fascinating entrepreneurial career with several exits, dramas, ins and outs, including a $26 million math mistake that he helped one of his clients find. But these days, Joe is focusing more on, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but helping clients avoid some of the mistakes that he may have made in the past and making sure that they do their exit planning correctly. So if you're interested in, you know, some finance stories, a little bit of war stories on a very interesting entrepreneurial career, as well as how you can consider preparing your clients or yourself for exit, stick around for the show. So Joe, thanks very much for coming. Maybe you can kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Well, thank you for having me on your podcast, James. Something that many people don't know about me, I guess, is that I was Entrepreneur of the Year in Orange County, California for the 2001 year in the business services category.
So very good. Very impressive. Honor.
Yes.
Well, you can always feel like, I feel like as an entrepreneur, it's a bit of one of those labels you just start to decide calling yourself. Most of us, you know, probably aren't real entrepreneurs, but someone certified your entrepreneurship in that way. It doesn't be gratifying, you know, not just someone's got a side gig going.
It was rather satisfying. Unfortunately, shortly after that, the wheels came off the business I was running. So it was a challenging time, but it was a wonderful award to receive and recognition.
Well, we'll get into that, but to qualify you to be on the Gross Profit Podcast, you've got to have real experience, and you started off with public accounting, I believe. That was your, so how did you get into that?
I did. I went to college. I grew up in Southern California. I went to a state school called Cal State Fullerton and got a degree in economics. I looked around with what my classmates were, the jobs they were getting, and it was primarily in insurance. So I decided to stay for another couple of years and get a degree in accounting. And I thought that was a better path. And I ended up going to work for a small firm in Irvine, California, primarily doing tax work. That I did that for about 4 years. So got my hours for my CPA certification.
Very good. And then that led you into the world of electronics or electronic business, I guess, or electronic IC solutions. So maybe you can explain a bit about what IC solutions is and how you came across that opportunity.
Well, I take a step back. I started in industry as a CFO for a company called Viking Components, and they manufactured memory modules for those of us that remember way back when in the early to mid 90s. It was a company that was growing from, I started, it was 26 million in revenue and it grew to 300 million. While I was there and learned an awful lot, but kind of grew dissatisfied with what I was doing at the business and always wanted to own my own business. And that's when I left in 97 to start IC Solutions.
And so while you were there, I guess I wouldn't want to bury the lead too much. We discussed a $26 million math mistake you found in that original business. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I was working, being this is the Gross Profit Podcast, the business ran primarily on gross profit. That's how the salespeople were compensated. And that's where almost the entire focus of the business was on what kind of gross profit we were generating. And when I started, I quickly determined that the salespeople were incorrectly calculating gross profit. They were taking whatever the cost of the part was, let's say it was $100. And if they wanted to make 20% or 25%, they were just multiplying it times 1.2 or 1.25 instead of dividing it by 0.8 or 0.75. And as a result, they were leaving a significant amount of money on the table. And we dropped that first year, we dropped a significant amount of money to the bottom line in ensuing years, continued to do so. And I calculated it out to be roughly $26 million during my tenure there in additional profitability as a result of that simple change. I mean, it was really a simple math error. But I had people fighting me tooth and nail, not wanting to make the change.
I mean, the pushback was, oh, hold on, I've got to go. I've been quoting people at 1.2 times profit, and now I've got to go back and ask them for another 10%, I guess.
Yeah.
And did anyone care?
The customers really did not care. It wasn't, I mean, it was a competitive market. The market in the electronics business historically has gone through kind of boom and bust cycles. And when I started there, it was going through, for us, what was a boom cycle, which would mean that product was very difficult to find in the marketplace. So we filled a gap in that the computer manufacturers were not filling. So we rushed in and the company grew pretty dramatically during the time I was there. It was quite a ride.
So I guess of that 26 million, you got to pocket almost none, right? So were you a shareholder
almost
in that business?
Or? I was not. It was owned by one individual who was roughly my age, and he kept it very, that was one of the reasons why I left, although he ended up giving ownership up after I left. So maybe that says something about me. I'm not sure, but yeah, that was one of the reasons why I decided to exit the business. I wanted to kind of be in charge of my own destiny, so to speak.
Wow. So hats off to him in his 20s, by the sound of it, early 30s, $300 million business.
Yes.
All of, pretty insane. Okay, so you saw the value you could add, sounds like, and you decided, hold on, I should be capturing more of this myself. So what opportunity did you come up with in order to do that?
So the company Viking that I had been working for bought a lot of product from the spot market or the gray market because we couldn't get supplied by the traditional manufacturers, the Toshibas and Hitachis of the world. And a day didn't go by where a supplier didn't fall down on us and not deliver what they had promised to deliver. So my thinking was I could get into that side of the business, delivering product to manufacturing companies, but saying what I was going to do and doing what I said I was going to do. So actually following through and being as upfront with customers as possible. Sometimes things do go wrong, but always trying to make it right and keep in constant contact with the customer. That was really the goal, because if they were dealing with us, they were typically in a very difficult situation. Their line was perhaps down and they needed product and they needed it now. So if we weren't going to be able to deliver on a commitment we made, I wanted to make sure that our sales staff was communicating that as quickly as possible. So one of my mantras is deliver news often and bad news even faster.
Okay, interesting. I mean, a piece of advice I received not long after you were doing this, I guess, when I was a whippersnapper, which all you need to be successful is turn up on time, say please and thank you, and do what you said you were going to do. And that's it. If you do those three, that's all you need. Sounds simplistic, surprisingly rare sometimes, to be able to find it. So why were the other suppliers dropping the ball? Sounds like, we'll go on to it now. It seems like a significant business you were able to build. So what was so hard for them? Was it not culturally wrong? Did they not do the right training? Or what was your guess as to why the service was so poor?
I think that I would say that the majority of the people in that space were not business people. Maybe that's the best way to put it. They weren't committed to their long-term success of the organization that they were running. They were really much more focused on short-term wins rather than building long-term relationships. So they would be take advantage of a customer in a given situation when they knew that the customer was in a difficult spot. And they were not hesitant to burn a relationship if it didn't work out in their favor. So that's the primary reason that I think we had so much success. And we started in 97. I had a partner in the business in March of 97, and we grew to 60 million by December of 2000. So it was pretty rapid growth.
Insane. I'm getting goosebumps thinking, just listening to this, all these people who managed to do this so fast. So it sounds like it was pretty sales focused before your competition was. Were you handling the sales yourself, or how did you avoid your sales team ending up in the same trap, kind of just taking advantage of people? Because I'm sure it sounds like it was easy money to be made when you had someone over a barrel.
There was. We grew very rapidly. I brought in, my partner was in charge of the sales side of the business, but we had agreed in advance that this is how we were going to run the business and not be as rapacious, I guess, as our competition, and build a reputation rather than as best we could in that market, rather than focusing on really short-term profitability. So we tried to inculcate that in our culture and made sure that in our training, as well as in subsequent reviews, that we were communicating what was working and what was not working for the sales staff.
Okay. So less people think that you were averse to not capturing all the value you can. I went on to build ebomb.com, and you ended up buying from one arm of HP and selling it to another. So, which sounds like an opportunity and great arbitrage. Tell us about that. What was ebomb and how did you end up selling to different parts of HP?
So ebomb stood for electronic bill of materials, and this was in the late 90s, right, early 2000s. And for those that aren't familiar with that time, I mean, the internet was in its very early stages, and we made a customer-facing software product that allowed customers to upload bills of materials, access inventory lists, and what we were doing, we were capturing information. So in the electronics business, a manufacturing company like HP, for example, they'll buy product from a component manufacturer, let's say Intel. They will take that Intel part number and then they'll give it their own part number. And oftentimes those part numbers don't match across the organization. So one division of HP is building computers, one division of HP is building printers, and the two aren't necessarily talking to each other. So we would capture information, we'd capture the manufacturer part number, then the customer part number and the division that it was associated with. And in this particular instance, we were able to find the product in an HP location in Puerto Rico in a different division and sell it to another HP location in Puerto Rico that was another division. And so we were the conduit between that.
Well, someone's got to pay for that taxi fare, I guess. So seems fair to me. Willing buyer, willing seller.
My partner actually delivered the product to the ultimate buyer after sort of sanitizing it and taking all of the HP labels and such off of it. He delivered it in a taxi cab. Yeah.
But you're making it sound far too easy, this business stuff so far, because everything seems to be breaking your way. But in 2003, that business faced some challenge. How did you go about negotiating that?
It actually started, I guess, in early 2001, where the dot-com bubble burst. Cisco wrote off $2.5 billion in inventory in March of 2001. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. And unfortunately, I was at that point in time, my partner and I had drawn swords against each other and we were in the middle of a bitter fight. So I wasn't paying as close attention to the business, but I ended up getting him out of the business. And then in September of 2001, planes flew into buildings and sort of everything was up for grabs at that point in time. And my bank called our loan and I ended up fighting with them for the next year and a half and finally settled with them. And I did end up getting the software that we had built as part of the settlement, but it was not a successful exit, that particular exit.
Okay. But you did manage. So especially maybe at that time, the banks didn't value the software like you could.
They didn't really have any idea what we did. They didn't have any sense. And banks, I mean, typically in situations like that, when it comes to technology, they're at a loss. They hired a receiver who was just maximizing the value of whatever he could out of the inventory that we had and, you know, physical assets and that kind of thing, collecting the outstanding accounts receivable and minimizing what he was going to pay to our vendors.
And it's just far too complicated to find. No one else is going to buy that software because understood what it was, right? So right. That was the opportunity, I guess. A little bit of a blessing in disguise then. I mean, I'm interested in this dynamic with your partner who's on the sales side. Sounds like you're more the operations. And that's often a duo that teams up together.
Yes.
Looking back on it now, I know you said it had some acrimony at the time. What did you learn from that? Like, what was good or bad? Why do you think it went wrong?
Don't have partners.
Okay, interesting. I hope my partner's not listening to this. Tell me more. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say that. I think there were warning signs kind of all along the way to where we ended up. So we originally agreed to be 50-50 partners, and we were both going to come in with $100,000 into the business to fund it and start it. Because it can be a rather capital-intensive business in the sense that you're typically buying the product in advance, and then you're loaning it out to a customer on net 30 or whatever, net 45. In the case of Dell, I think it was net 60. So you have that cash flow challenge. Well, my partner showed up with his hat in hand and with a sum total of $5,000. And then 2 weeks later, his vehicle was repossessed. So I decided to continue to move forward, keeping in mind I had left a job in 97 where I was 35 years old, 34 years old, and I was making, $250,000 a year. I was flying around the world on private planes, and I left a pretty good life, but I had committed to this and I was wanting to see it through. So I struck a deal with him and we moved forward, and we had a lot of success in the first 3+ years.
So this strikes me as very interesting because I've been an entrepreneur all my life, but I've never got anywhere near a private plane. You were actually in the bloody thing and then you decided to leave it all behind. Was there, let me say, a controversial statement here? Was there a God complex here? You're like, oh, well, if I'm so good in private business, if I step out by myself, this is going to be, it's going to be even better.
There was a little bit of that. There was a lot of focus on, and this was a big mistake of mine, there was a lot of focus on my success and wanting to be flying on that private plane, but being the one that was paying for it, that kind of thing. And I never got there. And when sort of everything, I guess, came crashing down, I was left almost without an identity because I had wrapped so much of my identity up in the business. So I kind of had to, I had to reinvent myself in a sense, went through some pretty difficult times.
Well, I mean, it's common. A lot of entrepreneurs, you get to the bottom or you think it's the bottom and you have to go a few stories below that sometimes. And
yes.
I've never really had that myself, but I've definitely, being underneath the stairs at a burrito bar where I was working, cleaning the floors and then cold calling people for my so-called business, So I've gone pretty low, I guess. But do you think that, I often think, well, that's great. Actually, that's the time, at the time I hated it. Now it's the thing I'm proudest of, like how I handle it. So you bought the business out of receivership or the software anyway. You couldn't go any lower by the sounds of it. What happened next?
So I got back into the same business, which we called supply chain risk management, selling components to manufacturing companies. And then with the software, I teamed up with another partner, although this gentleman had a tremendous amount of success, had taken an ERP company public. And we took the software and repurposed it for commercial use, where we ended up providing what we called brand intelligence for manufacturing companies. And our first customers were electronic component manufacturers. Qualcomm was our first customer, so Qualcomm was interested. Back then, they really didn't make anything. They just licensed their technology, so they were interested in seeing where their technology was being sold outside of their normal business channels. It shouldn't, in their world, in their mind, their technology should not have existed in the open market or gray market or spot market, whatever you want to call it. So we then branched out into luxury goods, pharmaceuticals, and ultimately, that company was sold in 2014. So that was a successful exit.
So just to get clear on what that is. So this is, Qualcomm owned the IP. They wanted to maintain control of the supply chain all the way to the customer. But their supply chain were saying, hold on, I have lots of people who would buy this. And they were kind of selling it on the QT to whoever had cash, basically. And you were
that often happened. I mean, that's really why the gray market exists, is that a lot of manufacturing companies, for whatever reason, end up with excess materials and they want it marketed out to the, because their supplier isn't going to take it back. So they end up having to either destroy it and eat the cost of that, or they end up trying to get some value back on it.
And even though they were under contract not to do that. So
in most instances, it's kind of a dirty little secret. Yeah. And especially with Qualcomm, because they policed their supply chain very tightly, and they had a former FBI agent that was actually running their security in this area.
Right. So it's strange because, I can understand how Pablo Escobar might need to audit his supply chain, the characters you're hanging out with, but did people just not think they'd get caught, or was it just cowboy country, or was there no repercussion, or what repercussion could Qualcomm bring to bear if they did catch someone?
Well, if they caught someone, so a company that is in a position where their IP is being infringed upon, that is based here in the US, they effectively have to build a police case that they then present to the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Trade Commission is the one that does the enforcement. So if XYZ company is selling Qualcomm's parts illegally, Qualcomm would have to build a case, would have to garner the fact that they are in fact selling it. So we would provide them with the listings, the pictures, the quantities, the pricing if it was available, and feed that back to them. And then they would take that information and roll it up into a report that they would then present to the FTC. So
explain to me why FTC, I mean, FBI, I would imagine, or, you know, like, it sounds like it's a contract law issue, right? So it's a civil case. And how come the FTC, because I associate them with sort of listings and, you know, regulation, and why would they get involved in a private contract?
The FTC, I guess, is the one that polices sort of transactions like that, cross-border transactions. I mean, the FBI would have been involved if there was something that was actually criminal. So the FBI would get involved if, say, counterfeit product was being sold. You know, it was being represented as one thing and it was actually another thing. And that became a huge issue. And that's one of the reasons why I got out of the business when China became such a significant player in the contract manufacturing world, because we, as a country, the United States, shipped all of our e-waste to a province in China, and then they would take that e-waste, they would melt off the components off the boards, and in many cases, they would remark them. So they would go through a process which is called blacktopping, which is where they basically take the top part of the component, the epoxy, off, and then they would re-stencil it with a different part number if it fit the physical characteristics of the part number that somebody was looking for. But it probably in most cases, it didn't have any of the same physical characteristics. So, I mean, a part could be going into an airliner or something like that that was mission critical, and sure, lo and behold, it's not doing what it's supposed to do, and it, you know, planes fall out of the
sky. So what I heard there was that the FTC is looking after American business interests abroad, like they would, like, you know, you couldn't. So that's the purpose of them. But China was getting away with it. They didn't have any influence there.
Yeah.
And therefore, what was the point in prosecuting it in the first place, ultimately, I guess? But you got out ahead of that.
Well, the onus in the U.S. falls on the company that is based here in the U.S. and that is, in fact, selling the product. So you, as a reseller of the product, need to make certain that what you're selling is in fact what you're advertising is selling. So you don't want to be selling something that isn't as advertised, and that's where the FBI would get involved or the FTC. So
right. Okay, so we're coming up to your first exit. We've had you exited the business, I guess. You left because you made them too much money, you didn't get your rent, and then you had a sort of a close call, let's say. And now this is, you actually got to an exit with that business. Tell us about, because later on, we're going to talk about how you're helping people with their exits. So I'm interested to see how your first one went.
So I had two that were within about 2 years of each other. The first one was the supply chain risk management business that I started up. And I sold that in 2012. And it went well. I sold it to a competitor. It was friendly. It was effectively sold on I wouldn't say an earnout basis. I mean, there was a component of that, which is something I wouldn't recommend to somebody that is in fact selling their business, because there's all sorts of, in this case, this didn't happen, but there's all sorts of games that could be played in that regard. And then the second one, the software company, I was no longer an actual operator in the business. I had left probably 5 years earlier, and there was professional management. Not that I'm not a professional, but there was management brought in by the board. And they ended up selling to a competitor. So I was just an investor at that point in time, and I didn't put any money into the business, and I walked away with a nice little sum. So that went well.
Very good. So now we're deep enough into the podcast, there's hardly anyone left listening, Joe. So we can just chat, you and me, about exit planning, because this is obviously a topic which people, any entrepreneur, will find close to their heart, I guess. I still do say, you know, I wish I never have to sell my business. I feel like people who sell their business are just people who screwed it up. And if you don't screw it up, then why would you ever want to exit? But now that you're in your sort of career now, if you're consulting with people, the first thing you said to me is that you don't have any payroll in what you're doing now. It was at your level of success, you could have decided to go either way. So let me touch on that first. You're obviously building a business you enjoy running now, and you don't have any payroll. Tell me about that. Why haven't you built a team?
Well, I've more or less been a solopreneur as a fractional CFO for the last few years. And now that I'm building this exit planning business, I'm anticipating having a team, but I'm not quite at that stage yet. So I say that having a payroll is the most thankless job in the world, because you can pay people 51 out of 52 times, and then you screw up on the 52nd time, you're the second coming of the Antichrist. So that's what I've kind of been aiming for over the last several years. But now I think I'm at a stage where the business is starting to grow, and I will be hiring people, analysts, things of that nature. But I'll also be managing, my role in this process is really to kind of be the quarterback, and I'll be managing outside providers, from legal to wealth planning to estate planning, all those types of things that kind of go into building a sellable business.
Okay, well, this is the first point I want to double click on, which is that, you know, actually the word for people who, someone's going to, there's business brokers, right? They'll help you find a buyer. There's things called investment bankers, which are unclear to me, but somewhat similar, but still don't trust them. And then there's obviously your CFO, and you've got your lawyer sometimes, and then your uncle might know someone who wants to buy a business. And then, like, but there's, when you mentioned this quarter, what's your recommendation to someone who's thinking about selling their business or starting that process? Which of those characters should you start off with, or none?
Well, I think you should start early. Start with that, because in most instances, it takes 3 to 5 years to get a business ready for sale. The statistics are not in the favor of the business person. First of all, this is probably the one transaction that a business owner is going to be involved in, and they're typically sitting across the table from somebody that does it for a living. So there's an inherent mismatch in the capabilities. But I would say that they should work with somebody that is schooled in certified exit planning strategy as part of the Exit Planning Institute. That's the certification that I have, and that it's a methodology that's called the Value Acceleration Methodology, and it really focuses on three things. It focuses on the business readiness, the owner readiness, and then the owner's financial. Those are kind of the three legs of the stool. So is the business ready to be sold? Is the owner ready to sell the business, which is a very big issue, because polling or survey suggests that 75% of owners are dissatisfied with the transaction a year later. And that's saying that 8 out of 10 businesses that go to market for sale don't sell. So it's, I think, working with somebody to, first of all, establish the value of your business, determine what it's worth today. And that this doesn't have to be a complicated process. You don't have to get a Houlihan in, you know, and spend thousands of dollars. You can work with somebody that can do, I wouldn't say a back of the napkin approach, something more sophisticated than that, but it's not a full blown valuation. And then determine how that stacks up to your competitors in the industry and that you're in. And then that's really the goal. That's the gap. If you're in the 50th percentile or the 60th percentile, that's what you want to capture over the next, say, 3 to 5 years. And there's steps to do, you know, whether it could be marketing, it could be sales, it could be raising prices, it could be any number of things. And that's where I come in.
Okay. So it sounds like, I'm going to dramatize this a little bit, but it sounds like you kind of, I say goose the business, but you do what it takes to make it look good for a couple of years. But am I reading too simply into that? Or is it, what's different to just trying to grow your business normally versus trying to get it ready for sale?
Well, I don't, this is a, the process that I follow is a continual process. So it's not just goosing the business, as you had said. It's not just dressing it up for, you know, for the prom, so to speak. You're actually building fundamental change into the business that is going to carry it forward, because that's what a buyer is looking for. A buyer is looking for a business that is sustainable without the owner. So that's one of the first things. I mean, can you, as an owner, can you leave the business for 2 weeks or a month or 3 months and the business continues on? And if it doesn't, then you have a fundamental problem. Probably too involved in the business. So that's one of the very early indicators of what will be ultimately a successful or unsuccessful sale.
So you've been in a business that was sold and you had an earn out, dirty word, of sales. And then you've been in a business that got sold after you'd already left. Is it a slam dunk that you should try and leave your business first before you try and sell it? I mean, is that the ideal?
I would say you want to be involved in the business up until the time of sale. You could even offer to stay on after the fact on a consulting basis, but I would suggest that none of the value of the business be tied up into that subsequent period of time, whether it's a year or 2 years or whatever the case may be. And maybe you're just not ready to retire. You want to stay on, but you want to take some chips off the table. So I would say you want to be involved, but also you want to make sure that you're not the business, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. It works without you. And I guess it can grow without, like, the thing, of course, my ego immediately thinks that, oh, if I left this business, you know, it would go off the rails or whatever. And part of me would wish that if I left it, it would to validate my importance in the world. But I guess I don't really understand why you wouldn't want to leave first, because surely that really proves that it's going to be sustainable by its own thing. Like, why do you recommend people stay in, even if they get to the chance where you can, you know, put a professional management in, head off? What's the thinking behind wanting to stay involved all the way through?
Well, I think, as it being your business, nobody's going to be as focused on its success or failure as you, as the owner. So I think that's the primary reason. If you don't, I mean, you're going to bring in a professional management team, but still you're going to be at the helm, really guiding the business and driving it. And quite frankly, if somebody has started a business and built it for, you know, decades, they're not going to want to walk away until they're ready, until they've hit that point, whatever that point may be.
So I'm going to ask you at the end why you decided to, you know, adopt a system per se. But before we get to that, one last question on, you know, the types of client that you like to work with. Are these people, could be at any stage, or is there a typical skew towards people who are getting ready for retirement, or what's the general sort of demo of an ideal customer for you?
So I would say there's really two strata. Here in the U.S., you know, we have the baby boomer generation. I'm at the very tail end of the baby boomer generation. I'm 62 years old. The statistics say that there's $14 trillion in wealth that is going to change hands over the next 10 years. So a business owner has a few options. If they're running a successful business, they can maybe pass it off to their children. In most cases, children may not be interested in it. They can sell to their employees under an employee stock option plan, or they could sell to a third party, and that third party may be strategic, or it may be a financial buyer. So, you know, here in the U.S., we have a huge private equity pool of money that's out there, but that's, you know, that's a whole art in and of itself. So,
and do you help people with all three types, or is it primarily, I mean, exit planning sounds like exit planning, but do you help people with, like, doing management buyouts or other strategies other than a strategic?
Sure. Yeah, those are all things that would come under consideration for a business owner. And a lot of that depends on what his or her wishes are. Do they want to reward the employees and give them the opportunity to grow the business going forward? That's where an employee stock option plan would come in. Do they just want to get out of town and sell? Maybe that's where selling to private equity or to a strategic buyer might come in, or even a financial buyer.
So let me ask you a little bit about your decision to adopt a system, I guess, would you describe it as certification in exit planning? I know there's a number of them out there. There's Built to Sell and there's different ones. What made you pick the one you've chosen? And why not just sort of roll it your own? You've got the experience. You've got everything. You know, you've done this before.
I think it's nice to have another badge, I guess. There is a network of people that are in this that share information, share opportunities. And I think there's also the educational aspect. So there's constantly events going on. So, and then also there's, as I mentioned, the framework, the value acceleration methodology that I can utilize. I mean, I could utilize that on my own, but it wasn't a significant investment to get certified. So
I was kind of expecting you to maybe allude to the fact, does it make it easier to sell your own business someday if there's a market of people, you know, you're working a system, like, good to go meta on this? Are the exit planning certificate recipients selling to one another or aggregating and all that sort of stuff?
I think there is that opportunity. I'm hoping to do this for another 8 to 10 years. And then at the end of that 8 to 10 years, hopefully I've built something of value that I can then sell to maybe somebody that's up and coming. I've got a book of clients, a book of business that I could trade.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Joe. How can people get in touch with you if they're interested, if they sound like they sound familiar, they recognize themselves at the end of this conversation here, how can they get in touch?
My email is the letter J, Stafford, S-T-A-F-F-O-R-D, at trinitybizadvisors.com. That's my website as well. It's actually Trinity Business Advisors. So yeah, that's how people can get in touch with me. I'm also on LinkedIn. It's linkedin.com/in/JMStaff is my LinkedIn address.
Very good. Well, thanks for coming. Thank you for listening this far into the show. I appreciate you staying with us. Your special reward, and this is the first time I'm announcing this, Joe. You're the first person to hear this now, right? So it might be a little bit old news by the time this comes out. But so I've been inspired by the waste, fraud, and abuse that's in the news recently and the talk. You can love them or hate them, but suddenly it's cool to recognize that waste, fraud, and abuse is not good. And we might, some people might laugh, I would never do it, at government spending. But let's face it, a lot of private businesses are not immune from this. So what we've done, what I've done is we launched a brand new product. It's called Red Flag. So you can get it at redflag.procurementexpress.com. What it will do is connect to your QuickBooks account and scan your account for telltale signs of waste, fraud, and abuse in about 30 seconds. It's free to try out. And if your special reward for staying with us in the podcast is to be able to go there right now and give it a go. All the data is not held in our servers. We're SOC 2 compliant. It's the easiest way you could maybe save your business, maybe easily save a lot of money by just checking for unusual transactions, random amounts, transactions out of business hours, transactions that have been duplicated. All of these things add up and can go slip under the radar very easily unless you're watching for it. So redflag.procurementexpress.com. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, James. Appreciate it. Have a great day.